Hi, this is Alan Chartok. Joining me today is my old friend Jerome Commissar. Jerry Commissar has held a number of positions in university and college administration. During his 16 years in the central administration of the State University of New York, he migrated from one office to another and was at various times provost, executive vice chancellor, acting chancellor. Acting chancellor was not his only thespian role. He also spent a year as acting president of SUNY College at New Paltz, and he was beloved there, and a year as acting dean of the Developing School of Management at SUNY Binghamton. For 8 years, he was president of the University of Alaska System before becoming an administrator. Jerry Commissar taught economics at the City College of New York, Hamilton College in upstate New York, and SUNY Binghamton. The Last Believer is his first published novel, but he tells me he has a deep drawer full of other manuscripts, some completed, but others needing rescue. Welcome, Jerry Commissar.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Alan.
Well, my old friend, this is an amazing book. It's great fun. And I am fascinated by what one has to do to write a novel. In other words, you know a lot about this. This thing is about, well, you tell us what it's about. Go ahead.
It's hard to put it in a simple, short paragraph, but it's a complex, multi-layered novel.
It is.
I like to think.
Yeah.
And it's about a financier, an American financier, failed financier, who finds himself looking for a new life.
He's been caught and convicted, but let off light.
He's let off light because he turned state's evidence, as all the members of his firm was willing to do. But since he was the least deadly of the group, they selected him to give the testimony.
The feds selected him, right. Yeah.
Right. Well, the prosecutor selected him.
Yeah.
In that case.
Yes. Okay, but, so he gets off with a slap on the hand. He doesn't go to jail. He's somewhat depressed. His wife decides to divorce him.
They're separated when the book opens up, and she is a television personality.
Right.
And his problems with the law has cost her career some grief. And she is a character who wants to be successful.
No.
So they're separated. Go ahead, Alan.
No, but how does all that you've done? I read your incredible biography. I mean, you were really a hotshot academic. And what I want to know is, how does all that you have done in your life? I know you've traveled a lot with your wonderful wife. I know that you've, had all these positions. And, how do you know what to write?
Well, first, after I retired from the presidency, University of Alaska.
Very cold up there.
I decided to go back to an adolescent dream. I always wanted to be a writer, and that was sort of stopped short when I realized I had to support myself and support a family. So after retirement, I began to go back to it and combined just a number of different experiences. In this book, I took a lot of experiences that I had visiting the Soviet Union and then after the fall of the Soviet Empire, visits to the Far East in Russia.
How'd you get there? I mean, were you there on a busman's holiday or did they invite you? How did it happen that you tended to be there?
Well, my first trip to the Soviet Union, which was at the height of the Cold War in the early 80s, I was representing the State University of New York. The State University of New York had a working relationship with Moscow State University, and there had been a five-year agreement that had to be renewed. Ernest Boyer had created the first agreement, and I went over with my wife and my youngest daughter.
Were you a lefty? Were you a lefty as a kid?
Oh, the cell used to meet in my father's delicatessen. I couldn't help but that.
Were you a New York boy?
Yes, I was a good Brooklyn boy.
Uh-huh. And where'd you go to high school?
I went to Stuyvesant High School.
So you had to travel from Brooklyn to Manhattan.
I went from Brooklyn to Manhattan, and it was a single-sex school at the time, and it was so crowded that we had a morning school and then an afternoon school.
Oh, interesting.
So,
but you had a test to get in.
I had a test to get in.
Some of us couldn't have made it, so we didn't even try.
I was lucky. I had a good day.
Okay, so there you were in Moscow and looking around, and were you thinking intrigue while you were there?
You mean in the 1980s? Not at all. And I went there wanting to fall in love with Russia. My father, who had left Russia right after the revolution, had this love of Mother Russia. It was really the love of the mother country. It wasn't the love necessarily of communism, certainly not of Stalin.
But he was a Jew, right?
He was a Jew.
And Jews weren't particularly well treated in this either Russia or the Mother Russia or the Soviet Union.
Yeah, but he was a Jew that was raised in an area where he had a lot of contact with the Russian peasantry. So he didn't have that kind of animosity towards Russia that other people did because of their particular experience. I mean, he did experience a pogrom. He did have to hide in the swamps at some time in his life. But he had a lot of contact with the Russians and had an abiding pleasure in thinking about the old country.
But this.
So when I went over to Russia at the first time, I really wanted to fall in love with it. And I was surprised at just, one, how poor the country seemed, and how restrained I really was as a visitor. When I first arrived, they said outside of some formal context and meetings that had to take place, that I could do whatever I wanted. But I went down a list of all the things I wanted to do, and I ended up doing all the things they had decided I would do before I arrived. So it was an interesting experience, but most of my experience with Russia was the eastern part after I'd gotten to the University of Alaska. University of Alaska, as Sarah Palin said,
I was just going to say
Russia from Alaska, right? I couldn't see it from the university, but the university did have a lot of ties, and I was on the board of the International University at Magadan. So I had a lot of contact with the schools in Magadan. Magadan, as you know, was the center of the Gulag. My feeling was that if you could do anything decent in that blood-soaked city, it would be worth your effort. So I spent some time working with the people at Magadan and other schools in the Soviet Union, and got to know a lot of interesting and good people during the 8 years that I was in Alaska.
As the head guy at the University of Alaska, which was a highly prestigious place, you got into a little bit of a fight with our ex-governor, Mario Cuomo, who decided that he wanted everybody to cut a percentage of their budget off. And allegedly, you stood up to him and said, you know, the young people at SUNY couldn't afford that. And you got onto somebody's S list.
That's part of my history that I try to not remember too often. But the governor was asking heads of agencies, how they could cut back. And I indeed talked about cutting back, but I made it very clear that cutting back was going to cost something, that it would injure the quality of the university. And he and I guess members of his staff took some umbrage at it. And since I was not appointed by him, but selected by a board, I was in some ways a ready target.
Uh-huh. Well, I was for you. So anyway, so then you knew the Soviet Union and you knew Russia, but now talk to me a little bit about the Ukraine, which is where we see this novel, is it not?
The novel takes place in the Ukraine, primarily Carpathian Mountains. My protagonist in this attempts to rejuvenate his life by going to the town of Pishkinizhyn. He is convinced that that's a place that may have some restorative qualities.
And he's convinced by a guy he meets in a Starbucks.
Well, he meets outside an old man, Martin Abramovitz, who's in his 90s. Now, Pishkinizhyn was the
I love that name.
The city where my mother was raised. You see.
Oh, is that right?
I was going back to the old country in this particular novel.
Have you ever been in Pishkinizhyn?
I've never been to the Ukraine, and I've never been in Pishkinizhyn.
And so your mother, did she tell you about Pishkinizhyn?
She told me a little about Pishkinizhyn. She, of course, was in love. When she was in Pishkinizhyn, it was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. I looked up my mother in the 1930 census, and she talks of herself as Polish. In the 1940 census, she was Austrian. So there was Franz Josef was her favorite political person.
He was a good guy, but I have to tell you that the book on the Ukraine towards the Jewish population was not very good. I don't mean your book. I just mean book on it.
Oh yeah, no. It was a rather sad situation for the Jews, and of course the 1930s was very sad for the Ukrainians during the terrible famine that they had and the level of starvation in the country. But I don't find much forgiveness in myself for the way they treated the Jews.
No, indeed. So, you have a lot of sex in this book.
Oh, I didn't think there was that much.
Well, it's plenty. I enjoyed it. So how do you decide just how far to go, as they say in Oklahoma?
You know, I think I'm pretty conservative when it comes to writing about sex scenes.
Well, how did you learn about sex?
The way we all did, behind the garage in Borough Park.
No.
Isn't that the process?
No, I get it. Okay, so the finish was terrific at the end. I mean, it really made you feel good. Did you have a plot all along so that you knew laid out, or did it just take a life?
It took on its own life.
Yeah.
I really didn't have a plot. The first thing I had was the meeting of Martin Abramovitz. That came first to mind. And the fact that there was a photograph that looked like Palmer.
Palmer being the hero.
The American, yeah.
And you were living and still are living in Washington, D.C.
Yes.
So you sort of were able to project yourself into this meeting in this outside coffee shop.
And the person he's supposed to look like is Rabbi Newman that I have here. And indeed, I had a grandfather by the name of Newman, and he was a rabbi, though I don't think he ever had a congregation. So I brought a lot of my family's names, if not my family's experiences, into this book.
Yeah.
But the thing I wanted to do most of all was to get a sense of how does a character survive in a society that has fallen apart, so that, you know, the central figure in the book is Ilya, who's an unrepentant Bolshevik. You know, his father was a Russian general, his mother was a Bolshoi theater, and he was a believer in creating a social order.
And he hated capitalism.
A collective. And, you know, it's hard to say he hated capitalism.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He certainly experienced it, and he sees some good things in it. But he still is hopeful that humankind will be able to find some better order. He knows that communism doesn't work, though he still has this great desire for some kind of collective society. And what I wanted to do was juxtapose him in a society that had fallen down with Benjamin Palmer, who's a financier in a society that is beginning to come apart. That Benjamin Palmer, who doesn't even recognize the fact that he was a thief, as he's told by Ilya, his crime is really undercutting capitalist structure. And I wanted to look at these two themes. It's sort of the old Cold War theme of communism versus capitalism, but in a different way, where the communist threat is over, but capitalism has a whole host of problems that it doesn't even recognize.
But you were an economics professor, and your father, we have already learned, was somewhat to the left. How much did your father influence the way in which you saw economics?
You know, it ended up not influencing it at all. I really became a marketplace economist, a Keynesian tendency. But I early on rejected the economic scheme that came from Marx, though not some of the social goals that he had. So, you know, my sense was that the collective society certainly was going to flounder and that capitalism was going to thrive as an economic order, but that you still had questions of equality, of justice, of how do you distribute the benefits of a robust society, a robust economy.
So was Ilya, who's the guy who takes our hero captive?
Well, he's first kidnapped on the streets of Kiev by a bunch of thugs. And then Ilya buys him from them. And Ilya has become a capitalist himself. He buys him from them, and he's going to try to ransom him to the United States. And that's the basic part of the plot, is Ilya wants to make some money from his captive.
But, Jerry Commissar, you're very, I mean, we can hear it in your voice now, respectful of Ilya. Is Ilya to some degree you?
I don't think so. Ilya has parts of a lot of people, but he comes out of some old philosophics, they would say, that I met in Russia during my visits to Magadan. Some professor, particularly a professor who had been a prisoner in the Gulag, who had this whole realm of experiences, who saw himself as a victim of the communist time period and of Stalin, and still had within him this sense that we haven't yet found how to create a good world. So I think that's a character, you know, that's the basic personality that's in Ilya. I've added you know, a little of myself and I think a little of my father in it.
Ilya had a woman living with him, and she becomes very important in the book. Why don't you tell us about her?
She's a young woman. She is the daughter of a former girlfriend of Ilya's, someone that he regrets that he didn't stay with. So Ilya thinks that Maria is, he treats her like a daughter. And she is a psychologist trained in Moscow, but having moved back to the eastern part of the country, Vladivostok, with a husband who turned out to be a rogue. She only calls him the louse. She doesn't give him a name. But she becomes very instrumental in Benjamin Palmer's life, and they become lovers.
As I read the book, I was very suspicious of you and what you were doing there. Because as they become lovers, it was almost as if Ilya, who was now holding him captive and trying to ransom him, intended him to become a lover of Maria.
You know, Ilya begins to like Benjamin Palmer, and Benjamin Palmer begins to like Ilya. And indeed, Ilya is a matchmaker in this. I don't know if he was looking toward a temporary or permanent match, but he certainly does play matchmaker and can't understand why Benjamin Palmer doesn't immediately try to seduce Maria.
Into all of this comes the beautiful wife, who is the TV person who has to go to Ukraine to try to rescue her ex-husband, who she had already left. How'd you figure all that out?
Well, she has a couple motivations. One of the motivations has to do with her own careerism, and she is thinking if she makes a documentary of her going to rescue her husband, there is fame and fortune to be gained. But there also is a sense of guilt on her part that, you know, having left him, she feels that, you know, part of his turmoil is due to her. And she joins with an old colleague, a mentor of hers, an African-American documentary maker, and they head off to try to locate Benjamin Palmer and bring him back to the United States.
So do you know her in real life? I mean, where do you get these characters from? Do you know her in real life? Say, yes, I know this woman, and, you know, this is what I think of her.
No, I think that she's an amalgam of a number of women that I know. Mm-hmm. There's no single person that I copied her off.
Yeah. How much did you work on this book every day?
I used to be able to write. I'm slowing down a little, but I would try to write 3 or 4 hours a day. This book is the last one that I wrote, and it took me, about a year. You know, I wrote it, and then, you know, rewriting and working it over may have been another half year. So it was a lengthy time period.
And why did you publish this one, self-publish it, as opposed to the other ones that you wrote?
I had an agent who was trying to sell a previous manuscript, and she referred to the previous one as the Alaska book. And she thought it would be easier to sell because of my age to be able to tell a publisher that indeed this wasn't a single effort, that there was at least one other book coming. So she said I should write another large book. So I began to work on this one. And when she saw this one, she thought it was more saleable than the Alaska book. So she began to push this. And when I decided to give up on attempting to sell it, I decided to go with this one first.
Tell us about this business with an agent. In order to get something published, you got to have an agent. And you got an agent, and it didn't get published.
She was quite good. Well, the marketing, you know, the whole publishing structure has changed so much in this country. And publishers now want to publish things that are almost guaranteed to sell. And this book, The Last Believer, and indeed three books, she actually was looking at three books of mine. None of them fit into an easy genre. They're not detective stories. They're not thrillers. They're not 50 Shades of Grey.
Well, they were pretty thrilling. I mean, it was pretty thrilling. You had a sense of dark music in the background and that something bad could happen to Benjamin Palmer. And in fact, some rough stuff did happen.
Yeah, no. I hope there's a lot of excitement in the narrative. I wanted people to get grabbed by the story and to stay with it until the end of the book.
Well, Jerry Commissar, how does The Last Believer, you've published it, it's attractive, it's attractively packaged, it's a very good book. I've read far, far worse in my life of published books. How do you get this? What's the plan in terms of getting this from being self-published to published by somebody else?
I wish I had one. I don't have a trajectory. What I am planning to do is get the Alaska book out soon and then try to advertise both books together and see if that breaks into the market.
Now, you're not a poor man. I mean, you've got a lot of pensions. You've got plenty of money. So this could be both vocational and avocational if you want it to be, right?
Yes. And it's more avocational than vocational. But I don't have plenty of money. When you live in Washington, D.C., and you look around at some of your neighbors, you can't help but feel impoverished.
That's for all of us, even in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. But you have pensions from the University of Alaska. You have pension from SUNY, right? We're not going to get the violins out and start.
I'm not going hungry.
Hearts and Flowers for you, right? You have kids, right?
4 kids and 6 grandchildren.
And have the children read the book?
All of my kids have read the book, and I think a couple of my grandchildren. My oldest granddaughter is an excellent writer. She's first going off to college next year, but she is more of a help to me in writing than any other single person.
Is that right? How does that work? You call her on the phone, or does she call you up and say, or does she email you and say, what the hell do you think you're doing here?
Fortunately, she lives close by, so she comes over quite often. And,
right.
And I could discuss different things with her. I don't discuss the sex scenes, however.
But she obviously reads them. Doesn't that embarrass you a little bit?
No. As I said, they're rather conservative.
That's what you think. Okay.
She's been reading other books.
Now, how did you resolve the violent scenes? There was one scene which really stays with me. You know, Benjamin Palmer or somebody's in trouble, and the very attractive woman, when they're being attacked, throws people around over her shoulder, and she knees them, and she, you know, the thugs. That was an interesting thing. Where does that come from?
Oh, I don't know. I think that's basically imagination. But it's at a time of story where Ilya needs some friends to pull off the rescue of Benjamin Palmer. He, by that stage in the book, he has given up hope of making any money on it.
Interesting.
But he doesn't want the deputy mayor of Kiev.
Really a creep.
Yes. He doesn't want him to have any benefit from selling Palmer or using Palmer as a political pawn. So he goes to visit some old friends and finds the daughter of a friend of his, of a former comrade that he had worked with. She's a cardiac surgeon, but she lives like a worker and she still operates on the poor. So he has strong feelings for her. And he asks her for help. And she said she can't do it herself, but she knows a couple women that can help him. And she was a wrestling coach and a wrestler. So she selects 2 women to help him. And as she puts it, not only are they good wrestlers, but they also read Gogol. I think that's the scene you're talking about.
I think it is. Okay, so there's a conflict here between the sort of attractive, you know, wife who is leaving him in Washington to be on TV and to be a star, and Maria, who is the woman who he finds and falls in love with. And you, Jerry Commissar, have to sort of arbitrate, I think, the fact that he's looking at these 2 prototypes, the Russian woman, the strong Russian woman, very attractive, but I get a feeling of sort of semi, you probably will disagree with this, semi-zoftigness, you know, she's a woman. She's a woman, as opposed to, you know, the bird-eating, you know, wife. You obviously liked Maria more than you liked the wife, although you were somewhat sympathetic to her. Is this Jerry Commissar's taste in women coming out in the novel?
I imagine it is, but I certainly didn't think of it in that particular way. But I feel for both of them, and I, in a sense, like both of them. But one of them is caught up, his wife is caught up in America's celebration of celebrity.
Mm-hmm.
And she's caught up in this society and not the best elements in our society.
And you make that clear in the end.
Yeah, Maria represents someone who, like Benjamin, is in search of something. She hasn't found the solution, but she is someone who is hunting for a better way, and so is Benjamin. So they come together.
You know, if you read the book, and the book's name is The Last Believer, and we're talking to Jerome Commissar, you come away with a feeling that you like women. You like women because you're not cruel to either of them. You don't stereotype them and you don't... But at the very end, just to make it clear what you think, she's riding, as I remember it, in a taxi, and she's back to work at the network, and the taxi driver says, I hope you don't mind my telling you... I hope you don't mind my telling you that I'm a fan. And she says, not at all. What was that about?
What I wanted to do was indicate that she recognized herself, that she wasn't blind to her ambition, and she wasn't blind to the fact that celebrity was very important to her.
Really? Because I didn't get that. And I thought, you know, well, thank you for saying that, because I like it.
But then I think she says to Benjamin that, you know, this is me. I like being recognized.
Right. Now, what's the drag from Jerry Commissar, from the university setting that you were in for all of your life to, you know, this discussion of this other world that you're in right now? As an academic, you have to be fairly rigorous and scientific. And here, is this a statement, take that university as you round out your career?
I don't think so. The transition from university administrator to writer was not an easy one. It was a difficult one. I just got very tired of administration, you know, seeing the same problems come across the desk for 20 years.
Well,
and
what
the same
were they?
Search for
what,
money.
What search for
well,
money?
Well, yeah. I mean, the need to get resources. I mean, I viewed the presidency as major responsibility was getting to the faculty those things they needed to do their best work. And during the years I was in Alaska and oil was selling for $12 or $15 a barrel rather than $90 a barrel, and Alaska's income, state mm-hmm. income, is dependent upon the price of oil. So it was a very difficult time. When I was with SUNY, it went through its own financial struggles. So I was a little exhausted by that kind of search. So I decided to do something much different. And I must say the change was not easy when you're an academic administrator. Well, from your own job, you know that there are constantly people who are asking you to do things. There's pressure on you. There's activity. There are people you're in contact with. When you begin to write, you're all alone. All of that is gone. You're not giving talks. You're not visiting conferences. You're not chairing meetings. And it took a while to get used to being alone and with myself. But I did enjoy all along the imaginative process, you know, thinking about things. I used to enjoy writing speeches, of all things. And, you know, I just enjoy the writing process and thinking things through. And writing novels, one of the things it demands, at least the type that I write, it takes a lot of research. And I always enjoyed doing research. Before I went into administration, I enjoyed teaching and doing research. So I found that in writing, that was easy. You mentioned getting into trouble with Mario Cuomo. The first book I began to write when I moved to Washington was a murder mystery with a political background. And what I was attempting to do was explore the politics of New York State through a murder. And what I had was a sitting governor, who I must say I designed very much after Mario Cuomo, except I made him a Republican. And then I had a mayor of a fictional city in Western New York, who's running for the Democratic nomination, and so you're going to have competition between these two. And when I started out, I had the mayor, the liberal Democrat, as the person that was going to be the hero in the book, and I had the governor, who's a rather minor figure, but he wasn't going to be flashy. And as I proceeded to write the book, and I spent a lot of time writing that book, Mario's personality began to come out. And I ended up with having a lot of good things to say about the governor and a lot of questions about the challenger. Now, I'm rewriting that book now, mm-hmm. but I found it was one of those cases where the characters in the book take hold of the writer and just have their own force.
Jerry Commissar, the great thing about novels is, you can get even with people who gave you a tough time, can you not?
Yeah, but it's turning out that wasn't my purpose, was to get even. But the fact of, if anything, this book will end up applauding a governor who has a lot of Mario's characteristics.
Interesting.
Well, you knew him better than I.
Well, I knew him pretty well. I, for a lot of years, did a weekly radio show with
which
him.
Which were terrific.
Yeah, right? Well, they were fun. But I also saw the other side of the guy and, you know, knew the good sides as well as, you know, some of the bad. I mean, when you're in charge, I mean, I've been dealing with his son a little bit here. You know, I've talked to him a bit and talked to his people a bit. They're not always happy with me. And it's tough to be, you know, on the wrong side of these guys.
No. Yeah. And I hope that in this book, if the book is ever finished, that I give those two sides to the character, because indeed they were there. When I began to write it, I was seeing much more of the negative. But as I was going along, the positive part came out as well. And being governor of a state like New York or any state is not an easy job.
So how is it to be a little older?
A little older? I feel a lot older. I don't know if I've gained any wisdom over the years. I must say that I've learned a lot from my children and grandchildren.
What do you learn from them?
Well, different views of the world, of what's going on. But beyond that, it's nice to have people who can tell you what it, remind you of what it is to be young, and simply by what they're doing. One of the things, though, that has really amazed me, I have two, one grandchild who just began college last year and two that are looking over schools right now. And the cost of higher education,
can you imagine?
I find amazing.
Well, $60,000 at NYU. $60,000.
It's unbelievable.
Year.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's a quarter of $1 million for a bachelor's degree. And then if the student wants to go on to a professional degree, you have to double that. It's frightening, and you begin to worry about what's going to happen to our society if we can't figure out some way of offering first-rate education at a lower cost.
Well, you know, I always believed, maybe like your father, I've always believed that if we're going to put a kid, if we want equality of opportunity for everyone, which is what the Republicans always say, equality of opportunity, then if you put every kid into kindergarten for free, then you should put every kid into college if you're going to have equality of opportunity for free also. I mean, I went to Hunter College. It was not a dime. Nothing, not a penny. So here you are as a college administrator, and you're being told little by little by little, public universities should charge some real money. It's got to be tough.
Fortunately, in Alaska, we were able to hold down costs, at least costs to the students while I was there, and we very slowly increased tuition. But some institutions, because of the public institutions, because of the fierceness of the state cutbacks, have had to raise money considerably. And you know, in my mind, it's very much like medicine. The only people that can bring about real cost control without losing quality are the people who are involved in the industry. Very often, they're people who benefit from the increasing cost. And it has to become a serious matter, both among physicians and among college faculty. Has to be an important desire to lower cost.
Now, there you said the F word, which is faculty. I think college faculty, having been a college faculty person for years, is the best job in the world. I don't think there's a better job. You know, you don't really have a boss once you have tenure, and you can pretty well, if you're good at it, you can enjoy yourself teaching and not teaching too much like a high school teacher has to really work hard. And, you know, you have to do some research, but most of them don't really do everything that they should. And yet they bitch and moan and carry on about, some of them do anyway, about how hard they're working and all the rest of it. You've been the president of several institutions, the chancellor of the state university. Doesn't some of that make you sick?
You know, it's so hard to talk about higher education in general, because the universe of higher education consists of so many different institutions. But I agree with you. When I tell people that the last honest job I had was as a faculty member, and it was also one of the easiest jobs. But, you know, it varies so from one discipline to another and from one faculty member to another. I have a sense community college faculty work quite hard. I have the feeling that many of the colleges, the teaching load is significant, and they have a lot of students they have to take care of. I think at university centers, the science group are really very hardworking, and much of their income is gotten on federal grants. SUNY had, as you know, four medical schools, and I found that the medical faculty were very hardworking. Is there an overinvestment in research, particularly research that is not funded outside but funded by student tuition and by university endowment? And I worry about that a lot. When I began to teach at City College at the time, the faculty teaching load was 15 contact hours a week. Mm. And the economics department only had 12 because we accepted logic classes. Now, I don't know of, 15 hours now seems like an insane quantity.
So what's that, five courses?
To many faculty. It was five courses. Semester.
Yep. And I've done that, and it's hard.
It's hard, but nowadays you had no more than two preparations. It was a large institution, so you could teach multiple courses. In fact, I think it was three preparations.
Economics 101.
Right. You have two or three sections of that, then you have two other classes. And you could do it, and it just wasn't that bad. But nowadays, very few faculty are going to put that amount of time into the classroom. And we say that it's because there's a lot of research, and in some areas there are, but as you said, in some areas there isn't any.
What about tenure? I mean, tenure is very important to us as academics and the rest of it. But we all know some people who've gotten tenure and stayed and retired and stayed.
It's always been a big question, tenure and the value of tenure. I've always liked the tenure system, particularly in institutions.
I liked it after I got it, Jerry.
I liked it as an administrator. Let me tell you why. Organizations have a tendency to keep mediocre people.
Right. That's true.
You fire the worst, but you keep mediocre. The tenure process supposedly forced a decision where you weren't saying you're going to keep someone for another year. You were saying you're going to keep them for the rest of their lives. Mm-hmm. And supposedly that made the decision a deeper one, one that really weighed the pluses and minuses of the particular faculty member. So I think there was an awful lot of benefit in the tenure system. Is that still here? I think it still is. At least at major universities, at many places, faculty take very seriously the granting of tenure.
Yeah, but not always for the right reasons. In other words, there's always some guy who's jealous of somebody who does better than, maybe I should put this in my novel, who's jealous of, you get 200 kids in your class and he gets 10. And he says, what's that guy doing that makes him so popular? And sometimes I think, in my own observations are, that some of the mediocre guys had less trouble than some of the stars.
I've seen cases like that myself. And very often it's the string quartet in the department needed a cellist. So you tenured the cellist rather than, a second violinist.
Or the German teacher.
Right. No system's perfect.
No, but you want to make it more perfect, don't you, when you do these things? Did you ever turn down anybody from tenure and have a major to do? I mean, we've seen murders of administrators who didn't tenure somebody.
Well, fortunately, I haven't seen that. But
well, it's been in the papers. Affected. We've seen it in the papers. Yeah,
yeah. But I was involved in a number of cases, particularly when I was acting chancellor and executive vice chancellor and as president of LASCA, because, the difficult cases rose up to the top level to make the final decision. And I did turn down tenure for a number of faculty members.
And what happens then?
Normally the lawyers came next, and you ended up in court, and normally you prevailed, usually you prevailed in the courts. But I always took those decisions very seriously. I mean, it's for many people, if you don't grant tenure, you're really throwing them out of the profession. And that's a weighty responsibility.
Do you ever wish that you hadn't gone into, you know, the university world, but maybe became an outstanding lawyer or something else?
Only when I think of the amount of money other people made. But no, I loved the academic world. I liked every aspect of it. I enjoyed State University of New York enormously. And Alaska was really a thrilling place to be, both in the state and in the university and in the context of the globe. When you live on the East Coast, you think of Europe.
Mm-hmm.
When you live in Alaska, your mind goes to Asia. And so it was an awakening to me.
How so? I'm sorry.
Well, you know, the Alaska is a Pacific Rim state. And so my interests were, and my contacts were very often with universities in Japan and Australia and in China and Korea and the Far East of Russia. So it was just the involvement with... you know, a different group of people.
Tell us one story about Sarah Palin.
She was not governor when I was there.
Yeah, but was
so
her,
was her
persona obvious in the state or what?
I really don't know. The people that I am closest to in the state and who I still have contact with were like me on the liberal side of politics. So you know, they were never Sarah Palin supporters.
So, Jerry Commissar, I want to go back to The Last Believer for a moment, your book, which I thoroughly enjoyed. How does somebody get something that's self-published? So, in other words, somebody's listening now. How do they get it?
Oh, Amazon carries the book, and it can be downloaded. Those who have a Kindle, it can be downloaded, I think, for all of $2.99.
Really?
Is the price of the download. And I'm going to be putting it up on some other, another electronic version as well. But right now, it's only the Kindle that it's available on.
One of the things I loved about the book was, you know, sometimes books end too early. You know, I love it when you get a little bit extra. You've been taken through the entire tension of the situation. Now you come to the very end. It could end on, but you, Jerry, give us some extra what happened next to these people. I love that part of it. And I say, good, we've had to, I don't want to use the word suffer, but we've had to experience the tension of the situation, which was not easy. And now it's resolved, but you really reach to give us a little extra about what happened next. It's like one of those movies where they say, so-and-so rose to be Chief Justice of the Supreme Court.
Right.
Did you intend to get a tear out of people with your conclusion? I'm not going to give the conclusion, but did you intend to get a tear out of them? Were you being manipulative?
No, I don't think so. But
I think so.
I hope I do get it here. I didn't want the book, in a sense, to end. I wanted the characters of the book to be looking to a new beginning.
Mm.
So I needed the last chapter as a way of presenting the characters as still breathing and working with each other to move forward. And that was really the intent of the last section of the book.
Do you ever think of what your father would think of your book?
I think my father would. When I was about 13 or 14, I was reading a novel that really did have a lot of sex in it. And one of my older cousins told my father read Yiddish a lot, but not much in English. And a cousin told my father that I shouldn't be allowed to read those books. And my father came to me and said, you shouldn't read that book. And I said, it's a novel. Dostoevsky wrote novels. And my father said, wonderful, and went away. So I think he would have enjoyed The Last Believer for a lot of reasons. One, he liked novels. And two, it gives a decent representation to the liberal in many of us, to those people who still think revolutions are possible.
Did your father and mother ever get a chance to know of your success?
No, both of them died relatively young.
When you were what?
Well, my father died when I was 17 and my mother when I was 25. I was just teaching on the faculty of Hamilton College, so my mother did have a sense that maybe something good was happening.
You have any regrets about your academic career?
Yeah, at times I wonder if I should have stayed as a faculty member and done more research and writing and not gone into administration so quickly. I think I was an administrator before I was even tenured.
But when you were there, you were at Newbolts. I know you were beloved. I mean, you know, you did very well, and they wanted you to stay.
We had faculty members like you at Newbolts. So,
yeah,
you know,
well.
It was a good place to be.
But believe me, faculty members are capable of great animus towards administrators. And you know that.
I know.
And cabals and this and that. That wasn't the case with you. So what was your secret of success?
I came to New Paltz at a time when it had had a very rough time. So I think almost anyone would have.
What preceded you before you said it?
It was the firing of tenured faculty members and the retrenchment in the system. When I got to New Paltz, I think there had been 17 tenured faculty members that had been let go, and the school was, you know, declining rapidly in terms of enrollment.
And the chancellor sent you down there to sort of take charge.
Yeah, and I was lucky. During the summer, I was able to work with some of the community colleges and reinvigorated the admissions office, so that by the time the faculty came back in September, I could tell them that indeed enrollment wasn't declining but was increasing. And from there on, things became better. I must say, when I first got to New Paltz, I was really frightened that I would have to fire other tenured faculty. And New Paltz's faculty was a very good faculty.
Indeed.
And I would spend every day worrying about not being able to get that place to hum. And I was lucky. I was really lucky. By the end of the year, I didn't have to let anyone go. And things were looking rosy.
And here's New Paltz all these years later, one of the most selective of the state university colleges.
Has it become that?
Indeed,
it
has.
I didn't realize that.
Indeed, it has.
Yeah. I didn't realize that.
Yeah. So, the one thing, I only got 2 minutes, but the one thing that's always bothered me so much about universities is that New Paltz in the old days were, you convinced me why you shouldn't give me tenure. And, you know, that sort of turned around, which was, no, you have to prove to the administration that you deserve tenure. And, you know, Alice Chandler and some of the other great ones did that. And that's I think, becomes a turning point.
Oh, it would. Yes. I remember when I was at New Paltz during the summer, one of the admissions officer, a young gentleman, came up to me and he said he had a thrilling day because he had an applicant come in. The applicant sat in front of him and said, why are you asking me all these questions? New Paltz takes everyone. And the admission officer said, we're not taking you. And he was so proud that he could have a quality standard, you know.
Well, Jerry Commissar, what a great treat for me to be able to talk to you. Man,
it's wonderful to talk to you, Alan.
Always admired and think you've done a wonderful job in life. Jerry Commissar is the author of The Last Believer. It's a novel. You can get it on Amazon. And we just look forward to seeing the next great novel that you're going to write, which is going to be a novel of academic intrigue, marrying your substantial knowledge of the way that the university system works and a whodunit. So, Jerry Commissar, again, thanks for The Last Believer, your novel, and I'm sure that people will go out and enjoy it. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Alan.
Been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.